The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Acute kidney injury and chronic kidney disease is presented by Dr. Mark Baldwin.
Thanks, Dr. Hubbard. It's good to be back here. I'm always happy on a Saturday afternoon, late winter, early spring, to see people actually showing up for a lecture when you could be out in the nice sunlight. So I think you should probably get a couple extra points on the either the certification or recert examination. Today I'm going to talk about acute kidney injury and tubular interstitial disease. The first lecture is going to be a little bit longer, and the second lecture is going to be a little bit shorter, so it's all going to fit within the hour window. Disclosures, none. I just work for the man like all of us. So, what is acute kidney injury? For years, we had kind of two goalposts in nephrology, normal renal function and end-stage renal disease. Everything in between there was this kind of ill-defined mass. And finally, we in the early 2000s, they started coming up with maybe we should have some criteria as far as what we call stages of kidney disease and acute kidney injury. Generally, the accepted version of this is an abrupt increase in the BUN and creatinine with corresponding problems handling fluids, potassium, phosphorus, and acid-base balance, usually greater than a 25 to 50% decline in the GFR within 48 hours to 7 days. A decreased urine output may or may not reflect a manifestation of acute kidney injury. This is the bane of all people on call. You get a call, Mrs. Jones has already only put out 20 mLs of urine. Well, she may have been dry as a prune when she came in and you're still trying to fill her tank. Of course, she's not going to put out fluid. So sometimes this may or may not be of help. The problem with the definition of acute kidney injury, and of course, we all know that if you get two doctors together, you have an argument and you get three opinions. But one of the legitimate problems is serum creatinine may not reflect the degree of renal dysfunction or improvement. Serum creatinine is a really good measurement for renal function, provided you're at a steady state, either steady good or steady bad. But going into and coming out of acute kidney injury may not fully reflect this. Urine output, as I mentioned before, may or may not reflect the degree of renal dysfunction. So we call this, for years we called this acute kidney or acute renal failure. We now call it acute kidney injury because that really tells you what's going on at the level of the kidney. In your handout, there's a number of different slides that I'm not going to present for time factor. So if you see a bunch of extra slides in there, don't think that I'm going to come back to them, okay? I give them to you just for background information. The two biggest criteria are called the RIFL and the AKIN criteria. And each one of these stratifies the risk of injury at different levels of creatinine and urine output versus time. And I just mentioned these, and they're a little more detailed in your handout. The epidemiology of acute kidney injury is that we see this in about 1% of all patients at time of admission. However, 2 to 5% of the patients develop this during sometimes of their admission. Now, if we look at critical care, of course, this really ramps it up, and we see this in about 65% of all critical care admissions. And as a result of this, about 23-24% of people will either have resulting chronic kidney disease or they're going to be down the road on their progression of their chronic kidney disease as a result of what we've done to them in the hospital. The in-hospital mortality of acute kidney injury is about 40 or 50%, right where it was about 40, 50 years ago. The problem is today patients tend to be a lot sicker. we can do a lot of things in critical care units that we didn't have 40 years ago. Obviously, in the ICU, the mortality is greater than 50%, even with dialysis. So we say that patients die with acute kidney injury rather than from acute kidney injury. There are three distinct phases of patients when they go into acute kidney injury. The first phase is the initiation phase, and this is usually a bunch of factors coming together at once. This is a drop in blood pressure, exposure to nephrotoxins, early sepsis, giving them contrast. You know, all these things start hitting sequentially, and subsequent to this, we start seeing a rise in the BUN and creatinine or a tapering off of the urine output. Then we go into an oliguric phase, which you can have oliguric and non-oliguric, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But this is generally defined as less than 400 mLs a day. This is the point when we may consider doing dialysis. Provided they overcame what caused them to go into acute kidney injury, then they go into the recovery or diuretic phase. And this is where you have increasing urine output, drops in the BUN and creatinine, potassium, phosphorus, and magnesium. You have up to a 30% mortality during the diuretic phase because people become complacent, okay? So when we have a patient who has acute kidney injury, this is the stratification. And most of the time of what Dr. Pryor and I see in a consultative practice, almost half of what we see is ATN, acute tubular necrosis. Prerenal azotemia, either from true volume loss, such as GI losses and that, or relative volume loss, like we see with congestive heart failure, is 21%. Acute on chronic is about 13%, obstruction about 10%, and unfortunately, all the cool things that nephrologists get all excited about make up a small percentage of consultative nephrology as an inpatient. So how do we make the diagnosis of acute kidney injury? Well, the current guidelines say anything above a 0.3 milligram per deciliter increase in the serum creatinine or decrease urine output really should consider acute kidney injury. A couple basic things that we look at, though, when we do this, the renal ultrasound. I love renal ultrasounds. I call it a poor man's biopsy. You can differentiate acute from chronic. You can see if there's an obstruction there, if they have a mass, if they're asymmetrical kidneys, if they have abdominal fluid, okay? You can get a lot of bang for your buck with this. A bladder scan, it's amazing the number of cases of acute kidney injury have been relieved with the placement of a Foley catheter, okay? And sometimes to help with the diagnosis, we'll do an angiography. We do this in vasculitis or polyuritis nodosa, intra-abdominal pressure. We see this really becomes a big deal in hepatorenal syndrome, congestive heart failure, especially with high right-sided pressures, and they can go on to develop a Frank compartment syndrome. I'll talk a little bit more about this. Laboratory tests, obviously we make the diagnosis based on a BUN and creatinine. Dr. Pryor and I are very factual physicians. You know, if you tell me you have kidney problems, show us the numbers, okay? Urinalysis, we still look at urines, okay? And then based on what the patient's story is going to determine what test we're going to be ordering, okay? Now, this is a red cell cast, and as you see these little red cells stuck on the cast on both sides over here, okay? The white cell casts, again, we see the white cell stuck here on the cast, here and here, okay? Other supportive tests, again, this is going to be based on the patient's presentation, what they tell you, what you find on physical examination. One note I want to make is kind of the new kid on the block here is uric acid. Uric acid, there have been some recent studies in the last year that have shown that elevated uric acid levels may have a role in potentiating acute kidney injury. So stay tuned for more on that in the next few years. And when all else fails, we do a renal biopsy. Both Dr. Pryor and I have access to really good renal pathologist, so sometimes this can really help us in solving what happened to this patient. The indications for a renal biopsy is unexplained acute kidney injury, hematuria, proteinuria, establish a diagnosis, and also to guide therapy, okay? If we do a biopsy and there's a bunch of dense fibrous tissue, that tells us it's dead kidney and is not amenable to treatment. Why expose these patients to a bunch of heavy immunosuppression? Contraindications when we wouldn't do a biopsy, small contracted echodense kidney, all that's going to tell us is you have dead kidney and you don't need to stick a needle in somebody to find this out. Solitary kidney, if you need to get information from a solitary kidney, we usually recommend an open biopsy for that. Obviously an active infection, uncontrolled hypertension, coagulopathy. Remember, the kidney gets about 20-25% of the resting cardiac output, so you're biopsying an artery. So you want to make sure their blood pressure is controlled and they're not on anticoagulants. And obviously a non-cooperative patient. We're not pin the biopsy needle on the patient. So one of the other things that we're confronted with, and especially in as general internists, that you have a patient walk in who's got a creatinine of 4 and hasn't been to a doctor in 30 years, and your question is this acute, is this chronic, or what's going on here? And this is a little table that can kind of help you quickly differentiate. In acute kidney injury, we have usually a well-defined precipitating event, sepsis, hypovolemia, medication, obstruction, et cetera. On ultrasound, they're going to have normal-sized, non-echodense kidney. They're going to have a normal parathyroid hormone. They're not going to be anemic. Phosphorus and calciums will be normal. And you may see casts indicating active process going on. While in chronic kidney disease, frequently they'll have a history of chronic underlying disease. Diabetes is still the most common cause of chronic kidney disease in the United States. Or they haven't been to a doctor in decades. I have a theory that you get to a certain age that the less you go to the doctor, the healthier you are. Small echodense kidney on ultrasound, obviously that's chronic kidney disease. They have a normocytic, normochromic anemia, elevated parathyroid hormone level, elevated phosphorus, low calcium. That all goes along with chronic kidney disease. So, in talking a little bit more about types of chronic kidney disease, we can define this based on the urine output. And we usually draw the line at about 400 to 500 mLs per day. 400 mLs is a minimal urine output a day to clear your daily osmotic load. About half the cases that we see are non-oliguric. And non-oliguric tends to have a lot better prognosis than oliguric. We define anuria as less than 100 mLs of urine a day. If we look at stratifying renal failure based on anatomic location, we have pre-renal where you have a decrease in the actual or what Robert Schreier from Colorado calls the effective circulating blood volume, intrinsic where you have a direct insult to the vascular, glomerular, interstitial or tubular parts of the nephron, or postrenal, where you have an obstruction to flow. And this is a nice little differentiation here. I like diagrams. For my simple mind, it makes a lot more sense. So let's talk about post-obstructive real quick. This can be acute, this can be a chronic, or this can be acute on chronic. Functional renal recovery depends upon the duration of the obstruction. You're going to end up having a post-obstructive diuresis once this obstruction is relieved, and it's a good idea to keep track of their urine output and their electrolytes, okay? In a patient with 10 ascites, check intra-abdominal pressures. These are easy to do, okay? If they're greater than 13, get an ultrasound, and consider doing a paracentesis. If they're above 20 or 25, you're talking about an acute compartment syndrome of the abdomen, and that needs surgical intervention if drainage doesn't relieve this. The most important thing is that the nephrologist's role in obstructive uropathy is to contact the radiologist or the urologist to come relieve the obstruction, or tell the nurse to put the Foley catheter in. Okay? So common things that cause this, renal lithiasis, calcium oxalate's the most common stone, followed by uric acid. If you see struvite stones, always think infection, usually proteus. Strictures, retroperitoneal hematoma, fibrosis, or tumor. Obstructing casts we see with myeloma, rhabdo, and ATN. Benign prostatic hypertrophy, cancer, neurogenic bladder. Intrarenal or extrarenal tumors can present as an obstruction. Renal vein thrombosis usually are asymptomatic. And again, think about intra-abdominal pressures. This is a picture of an acute radiologist deficiency. As we can see, this big, a big garden hose here, okay? This is a dilated ureter. If you've never seen one, this is a great example. Nice dilated calyces, okay? So this patient needs either a needle stuck in, a stent placed, or something to relieve the obstruction. So that was post-renal. Now with pre-renal, we have a decrease in the total circulating blood volume, or the what's called the effective circulating blood volume. What does that mean? Well, the effective circulating blood volume is the volume that goes around and either stimulates or inhibits baroreceptors, osmoreceptors, pressure receptors throughout the body. In CHF, we have, especially in the classic systolic heart failure, we're having hypoperfusion. These patients act like they're volume depleted, so we're producing all these neuroendocrine system hormones, namely the sympathetics, the RAS system, and antidiuretic hormone. This works fine if you're dehydrated, but if you have heart failure or cirrhosis, it kind of starts working against you. Either way, whether the body's truly volume depleted or thinks it's volume depleted, your urine sodium is going to be low because we're trying to hold on to urine as much sodium as possible, and your urine osmolarity is going to be high because we're trying to hold on to as much water as possible. So these are the highlights of pre-renal azotemia. In pre-renal, the most important thing, especially in the hospital, is look at their eyes and nose, okay? Look at their blood pressure, and there's a little bit of wisdom in looking at blood pressures because sometimes you'll see a patient with a systolic blood pressure, 150, 160, will have a drop into the low 100s and then come back up. Sometimes that can be enough in a sick patient to start the ball rolling. So really look closely at the systolic blood pressures, because usually in these patients, they have other factors going on. They're septic. They're getting tons of other medications. So this usually, again, as I mentioned, is usually an additive effect. And it's really important to do a thorough evaluation of the volume status, okay? This is what I call, for all, those of us that are old enough to remember Swan-Ganz catheters, this is what I call a poor man's Swan-Ganz catheter, okay? And my house staff and our students always see me go around pinching people's necks. I'm like, no, I'm not trying to give them a hickey. Here, I'm just trying to see what their volume status is. But this is really reproducible. And even when you get older, as us old people try to keep losing collagen, you lose less collagen in the neck. So this will give you a little bit better idea of dehydration, okay? So what are the causes of pre-renal? Well, any kind of volume loss, and the big ones are GI, sepsis, excessive sweating, prolonged hyperventilation, and then you have the ones where you have relative decrease in effective circulating blood volume, the ubiquitous third space losses, again, the diuretic phase of acute kidney injury, where you can go back into this because you lose fluid, and rapid correction of hypertension. Again, look at the vital signs, and you can really follow them. That's something I've really learned over the years. We can calculate a fractional excretion of sodium. This is a thing we all learned as medicine residents on how to differentiate pre-renal from intrinsic renal. Normal fractional excretion of sodium is about 1%. However, it's not accurate in chronic kidney disease, not accurate in acute on chronic kidney injury, or if the patient's received diuretics. If they've met these criteria, then you can calculate this, and this can kind of put it in, put you in the ballpark. Along with this, there are a number, I know everyone has seen a diagram similar to this. These things have always are notorious to show up on board exams, okay? They'll throw you a bunch of information and say, does this patient have pre-renal or renal, intrinsic renal failure or ATN or pre-renal failure? And remember, in pre-renal, the body's trying to hold on to much, as much salt and water as possible, okay? Then we have the nephrologist friend, dirty brown casts, okay? A lot of times you don't even, if you see a Foley catheter bag full of brown gunk, those are dirty brown casts, okay? When we look at them under a microscope, this is what we see. What is this? These are degenerated renal tubular epithelial cells that for whatever reason have caused to be sloughed off, get stuck on cast material, and then urinated out, okay? So these have also been known to show up on board exams along with red cell and white cell casts. So now we get into intrinsic renal aspect of acute kidney injury, and these can be vascular, glomerular, interstitial, or tubular. Usually these combine with different segments when they're fully present. You're gonna have acute glomerulonephritis that'll also develop into acute tubular necrosis. Now, Dr. Pryor is gonna be getting into some of the nephritic and nephrotic aspects. I'm going to mention a few things, but he'll go into a lot deeper explanation of this because we do have a lot of overlap in our talks. One of the other things that we've noticed is that frequently when patients present with an acute glomerulonephritis with acute kidney injury, they have pulmonary manifestations. And these are what we call the pulmonary renal syndromes. Frequently, these patients have the same story. I was feeling fine until a couple weeks ago. I had the flu or I had bronchitis. Really haven't felt well since then. And then a few days ago, I started peeing out dark stuff or peeing out blood, okay? This is how acute glomerulonephritis presents. We see this with lupus. We can see this with good pastures. We can see this with primary IgA, Berger's disease, or secondary IgA, Henoch-Schönlein purpura. We can see this with the ANCA-mediated or systemic vasculitis, post-infectious GN, and immune complex GN. Drug-induced, another one of the favorites. This could be due to something directly toxic to the tubules, which the great example of this are aminoglycosides. We can see this in the form of acute interstitial nephritis. The current drug that's best for this is Bactrim, especially at high dose in older people. That's a great place to try. If you want to learn about this, try that. Can induce renal vascular vasoconstriction. We can see this with nonsteroidals, another one of our favorite drugs, and cyclosporine. And then we can have multifactorial, and that is contrast media can hit a whole bunch of things. Common medications we see with acute kidney injury, of course, NSAIDs and contrast. Two new ones on the list, PPIs. In the last year, there have been a lot of publicity coming out about PPIs being a risk factor in chronic kidney disease, but we're now starting to see it in acute kidney injury. I don't know if you ever noticed, it's always interesting that once a drug comes off patent, all these horrible effects start coming out. But we know with PPI that puts them at higher risk for certain pneumonias in the ICU, and certainly at higher risk for C. diff. Well, we're now beginning to think that this is indiscriminate use of this is a risk factor for acute kidney injury. Years ago, our favorite antibiotic combination was Vancomycin-Gent, or Vancomycin-Tobra. It's now Vancomycin-Zosyn. Okay, this seems to really be, at least in our facility, a really great source of renal consults. And then, of course, all the other ones. And the thing to remember is that any drug can potentially induce acute kidney injury. And this is usually part of a series of events that happen to damage the kidney. So When we talk about vascular problems and acute kidney injury, there's a whole bunch of ways that the vessels can be involved or attacked. We have renal artery obstruction, we can have a vasculitis, polyarteritis nodosum, which I'm going to talk about in a minute, embolism, thrombosis, dissection, renal vein thrombosis. You know, usually this can be asymptomatic. Malignant hypertension. Remember, the kidney is right in the forefront in when you have malignant hypertension, and I'll talk about that in a minute. Severe and sustained hypotension, sepsis, dehydration, open heart surgery. If we get a consult on somebody who's post-open heart, the first questions I usually ask is, how long were they cross-clamped and how long were they on pump? Atheroembolic disease, microangiopathic hemolytic anemia, such as TTP, hemolytic uremic syndrome, preeclampsia, and we see this with transplant rejection. Now, what about glomerular aspects of acute kidney injury? Dr. Pryor is going to give a much more knowledgeable talk on this than I will, so this is kind of the Cliff's Notes here. Big ones here, when we think of rapidly progressive GN, we're talking about crescent formation, okay? The big ones are ANCA-mediated, either granulomatosis with polyangiitis, because we don't call it Wegener's anymore, eosinophilic granulomatosis or Churg-Strauss, then micropolyangiitis. We see this with anti-GBM disease. We see this with lupus or any of the post-infectious GNs. We also can see this with immune complex-mediated. What forms are these? Well, lupus is another big one. Cryoglobulinemia, and just for a hint, if you see anything to do with the kidney and they mention cryoglobulins, always think Hep C, okay? Membranoproliferative proliferative GN, and then IgA-mediated, either Bergé's or HSP. Interstitial intrinsic acute kidney injury, we're talking here about acute interstitial nephritis. And the big thing here is medications, okay? There have been tons of medications that have been implicated with this, but the biggies are sulfas, penicillins, NSAIDs, and now the rising star here, the PPIs. Infectious, we can see this with pyelo of any cause or other causes. We can see this as a component of systemic illness, such as what we see with leukemias, lymphoma, sarcoid, Sjogren's syndromes, Reiter's syndrome, can all have interstitial components to this. How about tubular problems? Well, we're talking here, the big thing we think of is acute tubular necrosis, which is usually ischemic. However, you can have tubular interstitial or tubular disease or tubular injury from cytotoxic effects. And again, this comes back to drugs. Classic examples of this are aminoglycosides, lithium, acyclovir, Ampho-B. And remember, the effects of the drugs are radically amplified in the face of volume depletion and hypotension. We can see crystal formation in here, tumor lysis syndromes, hyperuricemia, hypercalcemia, people who drink ethylene glycol. We also can see is tubular obstruction from rhabdo or intravascular hemolysis, where we have precipitation of either myoglobin or hemoglobin in the tubules. So, moving on to acute tubular necrosis, this is thrombosis of the vasorecta and tubular microvasculature leading to ischemia of the tubular cells, which cause cellular edema, rupture, and then intratubular obstruction. We can get this from any cause, okay? And the other thing to remember, this is the final common pathway of all untreated pre- or post-renal. Sooner or later, you start knocking out the kidney, knocking out the tubules too. So this occurs by a variety of mechanisms. The first thing that happens in AKI is efferent and afferent vasoconstriction. You see, the kidney's smarter than most doctors. Okay, the kidney realizes it's damaged, tries to shunt blood around the kidney as we're trying to pump them full of high-dose industrial strength Lasix. Mesangial contraction, and then we have a sequence of events from direct cellular injury that occur right here. This is ATN, and this is kind of a really a geeky nephrologist would think this is cool, but what we're seeing here is you see these big vacuolated cells. This is ATN. Here, you see this whole area is almost denuded of cellular components here. Okay. This is the area that's almost completely denuded. Okay. This is what we talk about when we say acute tubular necrosis. These are the events that lead to cellular edema, rupture, and sloughing. A couple other slides here. So, what do we do? How do we manage this? Well, first of all, in the absence of hemodynamic shock, crystalloid is preferred over albumin or starches. Okay? As a matter of fact, indiscriminate use of colloid can further worsen the situation. We know that hetastarch, which is a big thing years ago, now leads to acute kidney injury, so we've really gotten away from that. Contrary to what some critical care surgeons say, there's really no difference in outcomes when you use saline versus ringers for fluid resuscitation. However, remember, in severe hypotension, we still like to give normal saline. And with ringers, you're giving potassium and calcium, things that you may not need in a patient who's in AKI. Obviously, we need to closely follow the hemodynamic and oxygenation parameters. Try to keep the blood sugars under 150. Don't indiscriminately use loop diuretics just because you want to be safe. If you use them with the idea you're trying to mobilize fluid. Okay. So, a couple other things. High dose, if you're going to use a loop diuretic, use an adult strength dose. Okay, I'm sorry, in a patient with a creatinine of 3.8, 20 milligrams of Lasix probably isn't going to do much. Okay, I like to say sending a little girl in to do a woman's work. Okay, think industrial strength doses. You have to overcome a lot of factors. If you have that window of opportunity when you can get them peeing, you've got to use a fairly good dose. What about volus versus infusions? Well, really, if you look at the dose trial, it's really not a heck of a lot of difference. Try to correct the anemia, try to correct the hypoalbuminemia, correct the acidosis, intervention with nutrition. The best prophylaxis for peptic ulcer disease is utilizing the gut, okay? Avoid or DC nephrotoxins, namely, one of the first things I do is DC the PPI unless they have extremely high risk. And as I mentioned before, is there a role for allopurinol now or not? We don't know. Okay. I tell you what doesn't work, renal dose dopamine. Okay. Occasionally people talk about this. It still doesn't work. Repeatedly giving doses of loop diuretics in the face of anuria are not going to do anything other than keep dropping the blood pressure. Phenoldepam, atrial natriuretic peptide, statins, recombinant insulin growth factor, Mucomist, Eye of Newt, none of this stuff works, okay? Because God knows it's all been tried. Atrial natriuretic peptide is a drug that's been searching for an indication for years. Dialysis with biocompatible membranes will cut down on your mortality. And that great invention called the Foley catheter can sometimes relieve a lot of problems, and it can help you monitor fluid output. Okay? So, when we look at fluids, what do we do with fluids? Well, something I kind of battle with some of the critical care people that want to turn the faucet on and leave it running. If you look at the FACT trial, the original FACT trial that came out in 2009, that looked at people who had acute respiratory failure, they found that those who got higher amounts of fluid did a lot worse. A couple years later, they took that data, took the subgroup of 306 patients with acute kidney injury, and said, how did they fare? Well, guess what? The liberal fluid group, which was defined as 10.2 liters of fluid accumulation over 6 days, did a lot worse and had a higher mortality rate rather than the conservative group, which only had 3.2 liters accumulated over 6 days. Okay? I get this a lot from cardiologists in critical care. Well, the patient's up 10, 15 kilos. It's like, well, yeah, you turn the faucet on. You know, I can take a little fluid off, but they have a thing called blood pressure we have to watch. Okay? However, if you use furosemide, again, this kind of goes back and gives you a good case for using a higher dose of furosemide, actually the patients did better at a higher the dose of furosemide, okay? But again, it means we have to monitor our patients, follow the blood pressures, follow the electrolytes, okay? And this is a nice little outline for what to do at different stages of acute kidney injury. Contrast-induced, there's a whole bunch of stuff that's come out recently that said this doesn't exist or this has been overplayed. I think in some cases it still is relevant. The biggest highest risk group are people who have higher the creatinine, higher the risk, diabetics, acute kidney injury, patients who have a history of myeloma and dehydration or repeated studies. Those are all the high-risk patients. What's the best prophylaxis? Well, there has been a cottage industry sprouted around what's the best thing to do. And the one thing that has been shown consistently to help more than anything else is if you hold metformin for 48 hours before a contrast study. That will do more to prevent this than anything else. IV hydration, if you want to use saline or if you want to use sodium bicarbonate, pick your one. Generally, my rule is that, and this is from my interpretation, is the higher the creatinine, generally the longer I hydrate them before and after. Acetylcysteine, if you think it works, go ahead and give it. If you don't believe it works, you don't have to give it. Because every few years, there's a meta-analysis that comes out and says, well, half the studies show it works, and half the studies show it doesn't. If the patient's volume is overloaded and can't take volume, go ahead and give them an acetylcysteine. Again, non-ionic contrast, minimize the volume, increase time. These are things that really will help prevent this. So I'm going to get into a couple scenarios here and just talk about it a little bit. This is an example of malignant hypertension in acute kidney injury, and we also see this in a scleroderma renal crisis. What we see here is these patients have a hyperdynamic murmur, their blood pressure is off the roll, they'll have an S3, an S4, congestive heart failure, headache, and sometimes frank neurological changes, hematuria, acute kidney injury. If you do a biopsy on the patient, here we see the onion skin here. Classic for hypertensive nephrosclerosis. In some cases, we see this with scleroderma. If you have a patient who has scleroderma, the treatment of choice is an ACE or an ARB. Polyarteritis nodosa, they have a painful skin rash. Levito reticularis tends to be a little more common in men than women, usually in the fourth or fifth decade. Not uncommonly, you may have an association to hepatitis B and C. They'll have hematuria, proteinuria, acute kidney injury, hypertension. They'll have abdominal pain, diffuse myalgias. The classic appearance is the cherry on the tree, photograph here from a renal angiogram. Okay? Treatment of this is steroids and cyclophosphamide. Cholesterol emboli. We see this classically post-cath, post-cabbage, cardiovascular surgery, or we can see this spontaneously in people who have severe peripheral vascular disease and or use of warfarin. They have blue toes, usually classically the second, third, and fourth toes. they'll have a rash on the anterior aspect of their tibia. Levito reticularis, you can see stair-stepping, as we call it, of the renal function. Creatinine goes up a little bit, it levels, goes up again, it levels, goes up again, it levels. They can present with acute kidney injury, eosinophils in the urine and in the blood. White cell counts, elevated sed rate, low complements. On biopsy, what do we see? We see the cholesterol clefts here. As you can see, these little needle-like things. And please note, this is in a vessel. This is not in a glomerulus. This is in a vessel. Okay, this occurs in the small arterioles. What we think leads to the renal damage is not only obstruction here, but a secondary inflammatory reaction around there. Hemolytic uremic syndrome, or TTP. This is where they present with acute kidney injury, microangiopathic hemolytic anemia, thrombocytopenia. We see this with toxigenic E. coli, with a Shiga-like toxin. We can also see this associated with cancer, pregnancy, transplants, mitomycin or cyclosporine. the non-infectious cause tends to have a much worse mortality rate. They'll present with, in the infectious type, they'll have bloody diarrhea, which is actually a good prognostic feature. Purpuric rash, abdominal pain, hypertension, hematuria, red cell casts, dirty brown casts, anemia, thrombocytopenia because of the microangiopathic process. They'll have elevated LDH, lower tick count, and haptoglobin. You can see pulmonary involvement, and if you have CNS involvement, it tends to have a very poor prognosis. What do we see? We see schistocytes and helmet cells. Okay. Now, in differentiating this, in TTP, elaborates toxins that disable the Adams TS13, which leads to thrombosis from activated von Willebrand factor, and hemolyticuremic syndrome has dysregulation of the alternative pathway of complement. And then, it's from one of my favorite Mexican restaurants. This is a biopsy in somebody with HUS. We have fibrinoid necrosis, this black gunk here. This is fibrinoid necrosis throughout here. Then these are schistocytes or helmet cells. Looks like somebody took a chomp out of the red blood cell here. So treatment, steroids, plasma exchange, dialysis, clazomib or rituximab. I'm of the generation where we were always taught everything gets better with steroids. Now it seems that everything gets better with rituximab. RPGNs, Jack's going to talk a little bit more about this. This just gives you a nice brief outline. And then this is what we're talking about, just some nice diagrams of what a crescent looks like. Hematoxylin purpura. We see this in kids and then adults in their sixth decade. This is an IgA-mediated multi-system illness. Palpable purpura, arthralgias, fever, abdominal pain, intussusception, which is more common in kids, hemoptysis, hematuria, acute kidney injury. Acute kidney injury tends to be more common in the adult forms of HSP, but it tends to have a worse prognosis. Red cell casts, proteinuria, and on renal biopsy, we see ATN, crescents, and positive IgA on immunofluorescence. This is the rash associated with HSP, and this guy supposedly died of it, Mozart. And my screen just went off. Okay. All right, and this is a renal biopsy in HSP. Again, we see the crescents being formed here. And this is immunofluorescence for IgA. Anti-GBM disease or Goodpasture syndrome. These are IgG-mediated antibodies to the alpha-3 chain of type 4 collagen. It's only found in two tissues, the glomerular basement membrane and the alveolar basement membrane. This can present as an acute GN and pulmonary hemorrhage or a GN alone. Usually the renal and pulmonary manifestations occur in sequence and usually not at the same time. Tend to be higher risk in obviously smokers, people with recent upper respiratory tract damage. Again, present with acute hematuria. We can sometimes have ANCA tests can be positive in here. Linear biopsy, you have linear deposits of IgG and crescents. In younger people, it tends to be more common in young males, which will have both renal and pulmonary manifestations, while people in their 40s and 50s, it tends to be more common in females, and renal manifestations tend to be a bit more common. Acute interstitial nephritis, classically associated with drugs, need to be on a drug for 7 to 10 days. Any drug can cause this, along with a number of other clinical scenarios, but they usually present as a fever, chills, rash, myalgias. They really feel like hell when they come in. Eosinophiluria, okay, we always hear about this. It only occurs in about 30% of the cases, okay? You know, you'll see everyone talk about Hansel's stain, right? I've never been in a place that actually used Hansel's stain. White cells, white cell casts in the urine, elevated sed rate, low complements, supportive studies are going to be negative. You're going to maybe have a little proteinuria. And on biopsy, you'll see diffuse infiltration of eosinophils and white cells around the tubules. And this is a picture of acute interstitial nephritis. I like to call this an angry biopsy, because what we see is all these inflammatory cells around the interstitium and tubules. And if you look up close, you'll see a lot of eosinophils throughout here, okay? It's the secondary reaction in the immune mediators that cause the renal problem here. Treatment of acute interstitial nephritis, well, you don't have to sit through a boring lecture to figure this out. Stop the drug. Usually reverses on its own. In severe cases, we're going to try some steroids, although no really large trials have ever been done to show does this really work or not. Rhabdo, we know this in trauma very well, but the medicine service should have this really on their radar. It's from diffuse muscle breakdown leading to acute kidney injury, from tubular obstruction of myoglobin casts and hypovolemia. Usually the underlying feature is impaired level of consciousness, okay? Stroke, drug overdose, alcohol and drug combination, head trauma, prolonged seizure, or in somebody who's unconditioned decide that the age of 50, you know, I used to run a marathon 20 years ago. I think I'm going to go out and try to run it. You can induce rhabdo with that. Statins, other things that can cause this, low phosphorus, hypomagnesemia, refeeding syndromes, McArdle syndrome, gas gangrene, and necrotizing fasciitis can lead to this. Really, the key on this is right here, a large blood on urine dipstick with few red cells, okay? And generally, the CPK is going to be 5,000 or greater. Clinically, it's been our experience that it has to be in at least five or six figures before you start having full-blown rhabdomyolysis. All the things that are in the cell come out. So you're going to see all these things like lactate, phosphorus, potassium, LDH are going to be at very high levels. Low calcium, you can see a compartment syndrome. The key to this is early and aggressive treatment. Okay, you can give them D5 with bicarb and mannitol. Mannitol acts as an osmotic diuretic. The bicarb alkalizes the urine. Again, this is one of these things we've been doing for years, but nobody's ever done a controlled study to say, does it work or not? Dialysis may be needed, and they usually have a pretty good prognosis. So one of the times you want to call in the nephrologist to dialyze somebody, well, acute uremia, acute encephalopathy, pericarditis, bleeding, myoclonic jerks, refractory CHF, refractory electrolyte abnormalities. The classic thing with this is hyperkalemia, refractory metabolic acidosis, or toxin removal, okay? So what gets removed via dialysis? Well, anything that's small, molecular weight, non-protein bound, non-polar dialyzes very well. And these are aspirin, lithium, alcohol, methanol, ethylene glycol, all are removed very well. Barbiturates, INH, Depakote, theophylline, the other ones are varying degrees because these are either protein bound or large molecules. If you see on a board exam which of the following are easily removed by dialysis, tricyclics are not removed, okay? So just maybe as a hint here.